Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is September 12th, and tonight we're talking with directors and teacher consultants from the San Jose Area Writing Project, just down the road in San Jose, California. I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. Tonight, I'm so excited to welcome these directors and teacher consultants from the San Jose Area Writing Project to discuss their recently released book, Teaching Writing, Grades 7 through 12 in an Era of Assessment, Passion and Practice. We'll discuss the book and their answers to two questions posed in the opening chapter. Why might students wish to engage in the performative activity of writing? And why might they wish to engage in this practice with not just dogged persistence, but with genuine passion? I can't think of a better or more exciting show to celebrate fall and back to school, and this, our first show of September 2013. As always, if you're listening to us live, we invite you to join us in the chat room where we're posting links to materials related to tonight's program. Tonight, we're so pleased to welcome Jonathan Lovell, Professor of English at San Jose State University and Director of the San Jose Area Writing Project, Mary Warner, Professor of English at San Jose State University, Director of the English Education Program, and Associate Director of the San Jose Area Writing Project, Marie Milner, English teacher at Andrew Hill High School in San Jose, California, and Associate Director of the San Jose Area Writing Project, and Brandy Jensen, English teacher at Crittenden Middle School in Mountain View, California, and teacher consultant for the San Jose Area Writing Project. Thank you all for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
As you all know, and our listeners will know soon, I'm really excited to welcome you all here. Mary and Jonathan, co-directors of the San Jose Area Writing Project and co-editors of and authors of this book, Teaching Writing, Grades 7 to 12 in an Era of Assessment, Passion and Practice. Thank you. We're going to start with the two of you tonight. Mary, let's begin with you, and maybe you could just tell us about how this book began.
The book actually began when I was hoping to do a new edition of an earlier book that I had done on teaching and writing. And when I talked with Den Allen and Bacon, but now the Pearson editor, she suggested when I asked if I could do a new book or do a book, should I want a new book? And I asked about having multiple authors because I did in the previous one and had actually only one high school teacher and a student teacher who were writers of a chapter. But anyway, I got the response, no, I just want to, you know, maybe have a co-author. And so for about a year and a half, Jonathan and I tried to sort of get going, and I had to submit a prospectus as overall description of the book, the chapter titles, everything. And I did that in the fall of 05. But about in the after the Summer Institute of 2006, when I was one of the participants, I started to realize that, again, my whole sense of it's important to have the people who are actually right there right now being writers and talking. I got the idea to work with TCs. And I opened it up to middle school and high school teachers.
I was just going to say, this is Jonathan, in the summer of 06, Mary had been here at San Jose for a full academic year, and she became a full participant in the Invitational Summer Institute for 2006. So she was an insider in that world and knew the value of the collaboration that was going on between teachers across all grade levels.
And just to pick up again on that word collaboration, that's been a founding principle that I live by. And that's another reason that I really knew that that the best people writing this would be people that were already teaching and doing these things well. And so I was able in summer of 2007 to have some California Writing Project funds to be able to do an advanced institute, and then got some San Jose State faculty grant for 08, but we just continued to work throughout the years. And one of the things that was, I guess, also really important about this is the TCs who came together, and we had easily over 30 at different times. At different times, people could be present. The excitement they showed, the thing was, we had wonderful conversations and wonderful modeling of what we would do in the classroom. People would be all excited. I want to use that idea. Could you tell me about that? Or when we wrote and people brought in what they had started to draft, it was just, again, it was that sense of, oh, I really like this. It was a whole writing process that continued to happen over and over. And Marie can attest to the fact, and Brandy, that I would keep saying, if this book never happens, we haven't lost anything. What we have gained is the opportunity to have people share ideas, to really articulate the best practices that they had. So that's quick overview.
And yet, look at all we have gained by having this book. That's so fantastic. What a great story, Mary. Thanks for getting us started with it. I will come back around at the end of the program to talking about the relationship between this book and the writing project. But even though I've talked to you a couple times, this is the first time I realized that the connection between this and your very first Invitational Summer Institute. So thanks for sharing that story with us. Jonathan, you and I have talked a little bit about this, and I know you're both excited about the possibilities and worried about the pitfalls for teachers, and particularly for writing teachers working at this time. Can you talk a little bit about the possibilities and potential pitfalls of teaching these days?
I'll take as a point of departure, Mary, is a recollection of the Pearson editor who said, we really can't market multi-author books, and it's the same point of view that you might have with if you're trying to fund a movie, where you say, really, you need those marquee names, right there blinking at you in order to draw the people in. So the thinking in book publishing is very similar to that. You need those marquee names to bring people in. And what we were trying to do was something very different than that. We were trying to celebrate the collective intelligence of groups of teachers who'd all had a common experience of working together in one or another of the Invitational Summer Institutes. And I've served as the director of the Invitational Summer Institute for the past 25 years, just here at San Jose, another 10 years before that in Nevada and Teachers College, Columbia. But it was difficult to make the case for the value of that type of communal intelligence with a publisher, and I think that's essentially the world we're facing as we come closer and closer to the point where the Common Core standards are going to be assessed in the spring of 2015. What we're going to begin to see is curriculum materials that are highly packaged and that simply override teacher knowledge, that say this is what you must do in order to make sure that your students score well on these tests. And of course, the Common Core emphasizes writing like no other standards have ever done before. So there's that added sense of panic that comes when you're asked to do something that you haven't really done before. That was a pretty strong impetus to the creation of our book, is we wanted to put in teachers' hands something that really spoke to them and said, these are teachers who've all developed a sense of themselves as both writers and teachers of writing. And we think that is really fundamentally important, and we can't let go of that perception and the importance of that perception.
Great. And I think in your answer, you may have already answered this question, but, as I was reading from the title and then really enjoying the book throughout the reading, I was thinking how many ways this is sort of a just right book for this time. Do you want to say any more about why this book might, for writing teachers, be the just right book at this moment?
Yeah, the other thing I'd say about that is I love the way the book both represents in what it says, but it also represents graphically and visually that notion that collectively, teachers are just a whole lot smarter than they are individually. That's just as true of me as it is of Mary, as it is of Marie, as it is of Brandy, as even the brightest of our teachers. We're just smarter collectively than we are individually. And I love the way when you open the book, you see all 12 of the authors. And we were very clear in working with our photographer, who we hired. It wasn't a Pearson decision. We went ahead with the photographer, you can be sure. And we said we want to make sure that every teacher in this book is shown in the act of teaching, so that you see a teacher in action shot. And we got a wonderful photographer, Todd Rafalovich, who was just extremely skilled in doing just that. So I'm very pleased with that, and I don't want to exaggerate the possibility that this will make a different sort of statement than the curriculum materials we'll see rolling down the highway very shortly. But I am hoping that it will at least be held out as, look, this is a counterexample. This is what you can do if you have the persistence of a Mary Warner behind you.
Excellent, Mary. Excellent persistence. And related not only to our communal or collective knowledge at this time, but we communally and historically have a background. And the opening chapter, Jonathan, you remind readers of or introduce them to some of the founders of writing pedagogy on which your book is founded. Why did you choose to open with this history?
I was worried that, somewhat worried, I wouldn't say greatly worried, but as I got older, I was noticing that individual people I usually knew personally, but were also quite well known for what they wrote, I was noticing that I had to explain who they were and why I felt their contributions were so fundamental. And partly because that had been so much a part of my own evolution in the field of English education. It was just dumb luck or good luck, I guess, on my part that I happened to start in the field of education when the field of composition studies was just beginning. And so I knew I was able to talk quite authentically and in a good writing project sense, authentically and realistically from personal experience. I knew I could do all those things about these founders. And then Mary suggested a wonderful way of conceptualizing that in my title where she said, well, why don't you call it personalizing the theoretical? And I said, oh, that's great. You know, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm taking some theoretical perspectives on how to improve student writing, but I'm embedding them in stories that are personal to me and how my own practice as a teacher of writing changed dramatically as a result of my friendship with these wonderful, wonderful people.
Yeah, it is a lovely opening chapter, and it is exactly as you describe it, a lovely sort of history of our field, but through your own experience coming up in that field. So thank you very much for that. Jonathan, you can't talk about the whole field or the whole chapter, but if you could talk about one or two of those founders in this moment, who would you like to talk about and why?
Right. I'd like to talk about one of the founders I talk about whose perspective and practices I think are in danger of being forgotten, and another who's pretty well known because a new book has just come out from Heinemann on his work. The first is Peter Elbo. The second is Don Graves. Peter Elbo, I am actually coming to understand, is of much greater fundamental importance than I thought he was when I originally was introduced to his teaching with our teachers. And I met him shortly afterwards, actually in Washington in 1982 at the NCTE conference when Don Graves was coming out with writing Teachers and Children at Work. But Peter's perception was so simple that it's in danger of being forgotten. And the simplicity of his perception is the first thing that a writer has to know is that something that comes out of your head onto a page has gotten into somebody else's consciousness, you know, has made that miraculous translation from head to page into somebody else's consciousness. And he had a wonderful way of doing that in relation to response groups, basically just having people remember words and phrases that they remembered from a piece being read aloud. and then giving a one-sentence summary, and then describing the piece in terms of what it seemed like, basically making an analogy of the piece. And Peter's insistence on the importance of that fundamental transaction was transformative to my teaching, and I do describe that in the first chapter. But I think now that we're sort of coming into areas of attention to informational writing and argumentative writing, that point of view is especially important now, that without a belief that something you say is heard, is literally heard by another potential reader, you're just not going to have much appetite for writing. You know, there just isn't going to be the impetus for it. The reason Don Gray's is important, I think, is more familiar to more people, I think, in part because there's been a celebration of his life through a new book by Heinemann just this week, actually. But his perception was, from the very early stages, very young children have a tremendous and innate desire to write. In order for you to understand that, you just have to learn the invented spelling that very young children use when they begin to write. But actually, writing comes well before reading as a performative activity.
I wish every elementary school teacher knew that in their heart, I have to say.
Oh, yes. Well, Don Grace, at the end of his life, said the best indicator of an elementary teacher who believes that in her heart is that she or he is a writer themselves. Isn't that interesting?
That
was the end of life perception. Yeah. So it comes back to the writing project and the insistence that we have that everyone writes.
And speaking of things everyone can do, Mary, I love the practical advice that you give teachers in Chapter 2 about how to find and develop their passionate practice as writers and as writing teachers. Could you close out this opening section with one or two of those ideas of yours?
Yes, and actually it works well because the first thing I was just going to highlight is it's actually in page 22 in Chapter 2. But I refer to Peter Elbo and Patricia Belanoff's inventory for writers, which I would have my writing students do a lot of times, and then realized I should be filling out myself, and I would encourage teachers to do that. And those key questions, do you enjoy writing? Do you trust yourself as a person who can find good words and ideas and perceptions? Do you think of yourself as a writer? And I suggested the idea of just taking any one of us, thinking the writing we do in a week, and considering the various types of writing and what we enjoy and what we don't enjoy, and then thinking about our students and where they are in terms of what we have them write. But also, I cite several young adult works, because I that's another love of mine, teaching young adult lit, but that the great images from Liso in the book Thief. You know, the words are heavy. I've hated them. But the whole sense, though, too, of what words and language can do when, you know, we write. I proposed we write so as not to be alone. I adapted a quote from that was used in the Shadowlands presentation on C.S. Lewis. But at any rate, that's one of the things. I really would encourage people to do that sense of what do I write? Why do I write? When do I write? Do I like to write? And where is my passion? And then the second, just a quick idea, is back to our whole notion of collaboration. And I have a section where I talk about collaborate, be a collaborator, be a partner. And one of the really nice things about our positions here at San Jose State, in terms of Jonathan and me, our positions as in working with English education, we have a built-in connection, but we have also worked very hard to integrate so well the writing project and the whole preparation of English teachers. We work this with our Saturday seminars, in all sorts of ways. But I would say to teachers, you know, don't be alone. Find a connection. In many places, obviously, writing projects are centered at a university, and there's going to be, you know, there could be connections that way, but with your colleagues in the high school, in the middle school, where talk with other people, you know, find ways to accept a student teacher. I mean, there are ways that we can really kind of just keep learning with and from each other, because that's the whole point. That sense of, I would just keep encouraging it, and it's a pitfall that we can go into so easily. We don't have alignment and listening across all grade levels through higher education. It just makes the blame game that's so prevalent just so much more dominant.
That's great advice, and I will just tell listeners there's even more great advice in Chapter 2 about for teachers, for framework for thinking about finding your passion as a writer and a writing teacher. So they should, I keep telling them this the whole show, but they should get this book and read it themselves. Mary and Jonathan, thanks for getting us started. I'm going to now transition a little bit, and we're going to talk to first Brandy and then Marie about the work in their classroom and how it is represented here in this book. So, and then we'll all come back together at the end to talk about this book and its connections to writing projects. So thanks for this great start.
You're welcome.
Hi, Brandy.
Hi.
I'm really excited to talk to you about the research and writing work that you do with your seventh graders. But before we begin, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your experience in being a writer in this book.
Well, it was truly a case of being in the right place at the right time. I participated in the ISI. It's called it's the Invitational Summer Institute, but we used to call it the Intensive Summer Institute because I don't think I've ever worked quite so hard in my life. And I presented my project to my ISI group, and the following year, Dr. Lovell approached me about writing it up for this book, and I was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do that real fast, not thinking that anything I had to say would ever go anywhere. And lo and behold, I'm looking at a copy of a book that's got my name in it, and it's sort of amazingly incredible, and I feel so lucky to know Jonathan and Mary and Marie and to be part of such a passionate group of teachers.
Yeah, I bet you are really excited about that because it really, that all of that, the community and passion really come out in the book. You yourself are one of the co-authors of a chapter in this book that's focused on bringing passion to the research process. In this chapter, you describe an assignment that all seventh graders in your school do. Can you describe that assignment for our listeners?
Sure. So in seventh grade at Crittenden Middle School, we teach something called the iSearch. And it's significantly different from, Ken McCrory's original version. But it's really, it's a project where parents research the year that their parent was 12, or students research the year that their parent was 12 or 13, and complete a 12 to 20 page project with interviews, poems, a research paper, choice assignments, reflective writing that really shows us who they are as middle schoolers, and they get so excited about actually completing, which is sort of amazing for a research paper.
So I have to first tell you, Brandy, that I'm, you know, don't only work here at the Writing Project, but I'm also married to an eighth grade teacher, and I'm the mom of an eighth grader. And my personal response to your description of this project was a little bit of sadness that my own daughter hadn't completed this project. And I went home and I told my husband and my daughter all about it, and I said, I'm really sad that they don't do the seventh grade at your school, because I think it would have been a lot of fun for you to do and for us to be part of. So I really, on a personal level, felt like, oh, I could just see this would be a just right assignment for a seventh grader and her family. And I'm wondering, as a seventh grade teacher, with that's a different framework, why do you think this assignment is a just right assignment for your seventh graders?
Well, we can start with the fact that seventh graders love nothing more than to talk and write about themselves. Nothing makes them happier than telling you everything they can think of at the moment they think it. And that's a really beautiful place to start the research process with what they're excited about. But the research that we do, because it's focused on the year that their parent was 12 or 13, really creates a meaningful connection between their lives and their parents' lives, and they have a reason to research. And when you have a reason to research, it creates writers who are really willing to go above and beyond what they thought they could do because they're just so darn interested in what they're actually writing. And it's what they create blows me away every year.
Oh, so lovely. And I have to say, as the mother of an eighth grader, a very apt description of seventh graders. So in my limited experience, I say, yes, I agree.
Interesting.
I was impressed not only with the big picture of the assignment, but as I read your descriptions of the project, I was really impressed with the way you scaffolded student learning. Can you talk a little bit about the way the assignments are ordered and maybe give us an example of how you scaffold at each assignment?
For sure. That's, I think, one of the most interesting things about the way we've modified the iSearch to work really with middle school students. We have in our classrooms English language learners who are levels 3 and 4, who are competent in the language but definitely need help with the writing, all the way up through students who tell me, you know, they come in and tell me that they're writing books on their own in their free time, and will I please read 10 chapters? it's hard to turn them down, but you can only read so much middle school vampire fiction. So we scaffold the iSearch to begin with some of the most absolutely interesting stuff, which is the interview. And so we send them home to interview their parent. We practice the interviewing in class on me, and they always get a giggle out of that. They love asking me questions about when I was in seventh grade because I almost always answer. I get things from, oh, did you have a boyfriend? Did you kiss him? What did you get in trouble for? And it's always embarrassing to say that I don't remember his name, and no, I didn't kiss him because I was too shy. And they see how much fun it is to interview me. And then they go home, and there's this person who they are related to, who they love, and they get to interview a parent or a step-parent, or in the few cases where students don't live with biological parents or step-parents, the grown-up who takes care of them and loves them and makes sure they're okay. And that personal connection gets them hooked on doing everything else. They want to learn about the TV shows and the music and the movies and the news. So from the interview, we take all of that information and we start moving into the actual research. What did you learn in the interview that you want to go off and read the news story about? Think about that news story in terms of being 12 or 13. When we do the writing pieces, we write one piece. First, we look at good models from years before. Then we write one piece on the overhead together. Every year, I write a new iSearch project with my classes in class, and I solicit ideas from them. How am I going to say this? How can we say that better? What can we change here to make the sentence sound awesome instead of just okay? And from there, they write in class with sentence frames available if they need them. And out of 180 seventh graders, there are only 3 or 4 every year who don't turn in a completed project.
That's amazing. It must be such a celebration.
The day that they walk in, I'm giggly. And they're ecstatic. They're so cute. I should video it one year. They're so cute.
You should, because that is really such a thing to celebrate. So you're giggling and celebrating, and I know there are teachers who are saying, well, that's all good, but I have to meet the Common Core State Standards. You make the argument in your chapter that students can practice the skills they need without practicing test-taking, that part of the assessment. Does this iSearch assignment help students meet the Common Core Standards?
Yes, absolutely. When I originally saw the Common Core Standards, I did a little happy dance because the iSearch is exactly what the Common Core is asking for. It's writing that's multi-genre, it's reflective, pieces are interconnected, they have to synthesize information from multiple sources. It's how we'd all like to teach all day, every day, because skills are embedded in a context that really gets kids excited about what they're learning. With the synthesis of the hours of research, the interviews, the reflections, it's a beautiful piece of writing that hits every standard that we have in seventh grade language arts, including the new Common Core standards. And it's awesome that the students are successful and get the skills that they need without filling in the bubbles, which just makes us all cry.
Lovely and well said, Brandy. I'm going to turn this over to Marie soon, but I can't let you go, Brandy, without telling you that, as I told you, I went home really excited about your work, but a little sad that my own daughter had not completed this assignment. At the school where my husband teaches and my daughter matriculates, they have an eighth grade iSearch, and the eighth grade iSearch paper is on any topic of your choice. So all of the eighth graders, you know, do their own topical research. It is also a big whole school event and everybody bringing their projects on the same day and very exciting. But I was saying to my husband, just think how much more prepared they'd be to do that iSearch if they had this other iSearch in seventh grade. So he said, oh, can you bring me that chapter right now? So already your chapter on the great iSearch has gone to Albany Middle School up here, an hour away, and it's spreading already. I'm hoping that all the seventh graders in Albany will soon have the opportunity to do the same project. So
that is so exciting.
I wanted to thank you, teacher consultant to teacher consultant, for such great work and for the great work that you do in your classroom and for sharing it in this way.
Oh, thank you.
We'll stick around, I hope, because we'll all get to talk together at the end of the show. But now I'm going to turn to Marie. Hi, Marie.
Hi, Tanya.
Thank you for being here tonight. Oh, sorry. I keep cutting people off. I keep thanking them and then cutting them off. How rude. I know you've made a number of contributions to this book, actually, but in this segment, we're mostly going to focus on the chapter you authored called Empowering English Language Learners. Before we jump into the meat of that chapter, though, I would love for you to tell listeners about your experience as a teacher consultant, a writer, and as part of the team who wrote this book.
Mm-hmm. So that's a tall order, and of course I have to follow Jonathan, Mary, and Brandy, who did such a great job. But here I go. And you, Tanya. My experience as a teacher has been exclusively, I'm in my 23rd year, and I've worked virtually exclusively with second language learners. I have been at Andrew Hill for most of my career. I was 1 year at another school in our district and 3 years at still another school. The majority of students in my school district qualify for free and reduced lunch, right, which is the code we use for students of poverty. They are mostly second language learners, and I've taught everything from newcomers, I guess we still use that term, you know, the first level EL students, through honor students in an international baccalaureate program, the majority of whom are very EL. They're still struggling with English. They're perfectly capable of accessing complex thought and analysis, but they struggle, of course, to be expressive in a second language. So that's been a challenge for me and the thing that I've enjoyed probably most about teaching in the district I do guide. In terms of being a teacher consultant, I know Jonathan and Mary know this well. I get very sort of verklempt and teary when I talk about my experience with the writing project. It's what I turn to. You know, I have friends who open their cell phone, look at pictures of their kids when they're having a bad day, and I'm one of the people who gets, one of our pamphlets for the upcoming writing project things that we're going to be doing, and I look at that if I'm having a bad day and say, yay, I work with the writing project, and it keeps me going.
Me too.
In terms of being a writer, I did have I co-authored a chapter previously in a book with a professor, another professor at South State, Dr. Roberta Alfred, in a book called Educulture. And I really enjoyed the experience of writing with Roberta and being a part of that book, but it wasn't anywhere near as collaborative as what I was able to experience with this book because I didn't I wasn't able to meet the other writers of the other chapters. In fact, I didn't see their chapters until the work was completed. It was just Roberta and I were working together. So on this, everything that Mary has already said and Brandy has been the case, I learned so much from my coworkers. It was so humbling to work with people who are this creative. I took away any number of activities that I'm currently using in my class, inspired by what my colleagues did. Working on the book certainly put me in touch with what my students go through. Having people pick up my work and start editing it, revising it, and having those moments when I thought, that's not what I wanted to say at all, and yet what I'm being told is certainly better than what I, you know, had originally written, and thinking how sometimes I think perhaps callously I respond to students when I don't mean to, you know, all of those things. I know we all experience that, and we have that discussion of getting in touch with what it is to be on the other side of having someone evaluate your writing when you're doing it. And as we know, writing is our very soul, you know, and to have people say, well, I think maybe you should say it this way, was quite an experience.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that about your experience. That creates a really a sense of knowing you in all those contexts is fantastic. I was really excited to see that this book had a chapter dedicated to reading and writing with ELs, especially, you know, in the way that Jonathan framed it as we come into this new era of assessment. It seems like there are three big ideas about instruction for English learners that inform your work, and I thought perhaps we could take each of these ideas separately, and you could talk about each idea and perhaps illustrate each principle with some work from your class.
Okay,
good. The first principle has to do with the affective filter. Can you talk about that, please?
Yeah, so I know a lot of people even regard that term as old school. I talked to some of the newer people in EL education, ELD education, and a lot of them aren't even familiar with it, which was interesting to me. But I think it resonated maybe the most with me 24 years ago when I was doing my training, because it's so simple. I mean, when you actually look at it, you think about your own development in life, it's true that any situation in which there was terror was unlikely to be a productive learning experience. And I'm someone who has studied a variety of languages, and I will have to say that I don't feel I did very well in any of them, and I think mostly because I experienced fear. I studied sign language, I studied French in college, and I studied Spanish in high school. And I would say that I'm probably pretty mediocre, you know, in each of those languages. But when I look back at it, I think because a lot of it was fear. And so I learned about the notion that simply taking anything into account that might frighten a student who's learning to read, speak, and write in another language, anything you can do to alleviate that fear is going to go a long way towards developing their confidence. Meant a lot to me, and I strive to do this not only in my EL classes, but in all my classes. So one of the ways this might look in one of my EL classes, something I discuss in the book, is having students work read aloud, and how if students are particularly struggling with language, I like to do a lot of the reading of their work aloud myself. I make the adjustments into, you know, quote-unquote standard English as I'm reading what they've written, not to the degree that I destroy their voice, but so that what they read is intelligible, that they're able to hear it in a more standard fashion and still be validated. They won't feel embarrassed. You know, I wouldn't sit up there and read something where some of the maybe higher level students would snicker or find something uncomfortable. And I find that having an authentic audience, having your work read aloud and validated, having it read in a manner that's not, you know, derogatory, is very supportive. And once I start doing it, the students will say to me, if they've written something and it's the day when I haven't chosen to read it, they say, I don't understand why you're not reading this. We always read our work. So that's always very gratifying.
That's nice. Thank you. A second principle that you, or big idea that you talk about in the chapter, is the idea that learning language and learning content are related. Can you talk about that idea?
So would you like me to discuss one of the instances of it in the book and come at it that way? Maybe the primate study?
Oh, sure. That'd be great.
Okay. Yeah, a little bit. So, of course, I'm an English teacher, but I started out as a primatology major in college. So I have an intense interest and passion myself for the study of primatology. And many years ago when I was teaching a very, quote-unquote, remedial writing course, a summer school course for the then AB 65 writing test, I was at the end of the day, had some spare time, was trying to fill maybe 3 minutes, you know, at the end of a Friday. And I started talking about Coco the gorilla, who does sign language, and I heard some little news story about her. And my students, who had not been particularly motivated that day, were suddenly beside themselves, practically on their feet, wanting to know everything they could know about Coco. And so I grabbed the proverbial teaching moment, went to the board, started writing. I think we were working on compound complex sentences, and I started writing those about Coco content, as I call it. And as I say in the book, I never, ever, ever looked back. In fact, right now in my classes, in my Sadai class, my shelter class, we're doing the primate unit, and students are writing reflectively, persuasively, informatively, and grammatically regarding the content of primatology. And they are psyched. They're so excited. One boy told me he made his parents take him to the zoo since we have no money for a field trip so he could go and look at gorillas.
That is so great. And I think it's an idea that's really important these days. I feel like it's an idea that's sort of gotten lost in learning language as a skill, reading particularly, and learning math as a skill. I think we've forgotten that those are tools that we use because we're excited about something. So the way that you've brought your passion to the classroom and gotten kids excited about something that they then need to develop language to talk about, that's fantastic. And then you have this third idea, which is about balancing desire for student writers to construct meaning with your desire to support them toward the refinement of their language usage.
So George Bunch of UC Santa Cruz is someone who wrote a particularly inspiring piece about this. I'm not remembering the title of it offhand. But I remember feeling so validated when I read that. And I gave a closing presentation last week here at the Writing Project in San Jose where I was discussing this notion that when with our own children, so you know this with your own kids, Tanya, if our children come to us one day and say that the teacher teached me something, let's say they're in kindergarten or preschool, we would never say to our own children, until you realize that that is an irregular form of the verb and you use the word taught, I can't engage in any further conversation with you. Say that like that, it's so ludicrous. And
right.
Yet for many years, and I know even people I continue to speak to in outside of the writing project, people will say, oh, I'm not going to let my EL student move on to writing paragraphs until they can write the perfect sentence or until they can write correctly, until their phrasing is correct or their irregular verbs are correct, I'm not going to engage them in any meaningful content because that can't be done. And I say, that's ridiculous. Your children at 4 knew so much about the world, right? Astonishing things about the world, even when they still thought the word was teached and not taught. And so I found, and I've been noticing this recently with my this particular unit I do with the primatology, that the students are very interested in abstract concepts such as I had a girl write a paper defending whether we should refer to the killing of the higher primates as being murder rather than killing because the animals are so much like humans, and she was supporting her paper with evidence on why that's the case. Quite substantial writing, even though she has a long way to go, you know, in developing the refinement of her language usage. And it's not to say that we disregard that, but the idea that that can't be first, because if I were a little one and a parent said to me, I'm not talking to you until you get taught down, I think I would have just shut up.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. In the first chapter, I used a similar analogy, and I said, we would now have a nation of mutes. Congressively, by
chastising
them into silence.
Marie, thanks for this sort of overview of thinking about your work with English learners. And I think for many teachers who could have been teaching English learners for a dozen years or more under NCLB, thinking about writing with English learners is, I think it's a little daunting or nervous-making. And this is just such a beautiful chapter about work that naturally grows out of interests and passions, and but scaffolds and supports English learners so beautifully. So thanks very much for that contribution.
And thank you, Tanya.
And I'm wondering if there's anything from your chapter that I haven't given, because I sort of gave you this frame, if there's anything else you'd want to say about your work that I haven't, within this frame, given you the opportunity to talk about.
Oh, well, you talk a lot about modeling. Mary was reminding me here. I'm known as, you know, the modeling queen, as well as the gorilla woman. I hope it's not derogatory. In my school, because I do a lot of modeling. I model with all of my students, but with the EL students, I traditionally do a model for virtually any kind of writing they're going to do. So we do one together, which is a pretty tedious process, you know, for the teacher. And I, you know, go through that step by step in the book. I wouldn't do that here. But it's pretty time consuming. With an EL class, let's say a page and a half of essay might take 4 or 5 days in a classroom of modeling with kids and having them contribute and write, et cetera, et cetera. But I do find that there's an incredible improvement in the work that I get from them each time, which is why I choose to do it. And I cannot emphasize strongly enough how important I think it is. I actually have the process of modeling modeled for me by one of my first mentors, Suzanne Torres at Overfelt High School, and I had never had modeling done for me in my own high school career, so it was quite illuminating, and I took that from her and thanked her profusely when I was writing this book for, I think I mentioned her name in the book, for encouraging me to do this, and I explained to people whose students taught with me that you get a tremendous payoff for doing this.
Lovely. Thank you, Marie, and thank all of you so much. I would love to turn in these closing minutes to talk about the relationship of this book to its writing project roots. I was really struck as I read this book that it feels like a very writing project book, and I wonder if each of you might talk about the impact of the writing project on your thinking about teaching writing and or on professional development of teachers.
I'd like to address that, Tanya, and thanks for the invitation to do so. Because in my own case, I had the, you might say, the accidental opportunity to begin my work in the field of English education with a pretty intimate knowledge of the work of Don Graves and Lucy Calkins, and I became very familiar with that notion that Marie just described of one of the functions of teachers being to open up avenues which allowed very young children to express themselves in writing and speaking in ways that hadn't been going on in classrooms, and also the notion that students actually are able to write before they're able to read. That was the truly revolutionary notion that Don Graves brought. But it wasn't until I moved to the West Coast in 81 and became first a participant in the Bay Area Writing Project and then a director of the Northern Nevada Writing Project and now the San Jose Area Writing Project, that I began to see that something very similar was going on with teachers, quite surprisingly, that in a quite analogous way, teachers were accustomed to not being heard, to being silenced, partly because of the structure of public schooling and the relation of supervisors to workers, teachers, of course, being the workers, supervisors being supposedly the people who know more and dictate to you what you should do next. And as I said in the opening remarks, we're about to see a tidal wave of this same type of thinking rolling down the highway as we move closer and closer to the common core standards assessment in the spring of 2015. So I think it's especially important right now to really be quite strident in our assertion that teachers not only have voices, but they have knowledge, practitioner knowledge that simply must be heard, and that it really is, in a way, our job in the field of being teacher educators, Mary and my job, it really is our job to make sure that we are providing avenues and access and opportunities for those teachers to be heard and very thankfully on a national stage right now with the publication of this book.
If I could piggyback on what Jonathan said, just a thank you to Jonathan and Mary from someone who, before I did the ISI that summer in 08, used to say to people that I was just a classroom teacher and that what I did every day was just something that I did and that it didn't have any greater impact. And the writing project switched my thinking to I have something to say and I think that all teachers should be heard and I want to help empower other teachers to be able to do that. I push people toward the writing project every chance I get.
Nice.
Great.
I think, too, there's that something that I have just used a lot is that notion of I wish that we would get, you know, that those of us who actually know a field and know a certain area would get asked. I often say I'm extremely non-mechanical. Mm-hmm. I do not try to tell people how to fix their cars. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think the parallel here is, and this is something of an overarching reason why I did the notion for this book, the notion for the earlier book that I did, I'm teaching and writing. Teach so often, people haven't had, because we're English teachers, we sort of have a facility with words and reading and language. That's what's drawn us into the field. And we probably, this is my case, sort of learned to write by reading and osmosis and in a sense, it just kind of operated out of that. You know, in teaching writing, and in a sense, following all kinds of really good integration of writing and reading and making this a streamlined, seamless, comprehensive literacies, you know, together. And so the thing is that what this does, what the writing project does, is allow people, first of all, to see that they actually are doing what standards articulate, when we started this book, it was prior to the publication of the CCS. And when we had to go back, and one of the things that our Pearson editor asked us to do was, she said, can you align? Because these standards are a big thing. And so the alignment of the anchor standards for reading, writing, language, and speaking, listening, we were able to do that very easily. Look, it's here. And so I think one of the things that kind of it's sort of the fact that this, again, what the teacher knowledge is already embedded in us, and we have the opportunity through a vehicle like the Writing Project or through a vehicle like this book and the work that we did creating it to share what we already have, we already know.
Very nice.
Do I have a chance to jump in briefly? Or
absolutely.
Yeah. So I was thinking about the title of our book. The original title was From the Heart, and then we had a change in the subtitle of the book to Passion and Practice. And I've had the few colleagues that have spoken to me about the book have said, is that a student's passion and practice, or is that a teacher's passion and teaching practices? And I've said, well, it's really both, which I think is the beauty of it. And I think the passion and practice ties into the whole writing project notion of teachers teaching teachers, the idea that we bring that passion to our seminars, our presentations, our workshops, our professional learning communities for teachers to hopefully instill that passion into them for the practice that what they do practice as educators, but also that hopefully that carries on to the students, right? That the students will then find their voices, find a passion, and on a very elementary level through practice, you know, what we used to call time on task, that the more they're writing and practicing that skill, the better they'll become, but that always has to include their voice, the passion.
That's beautiful. Thanks. This is, you know, probably the greatest thing about my job is I get to talk to Writing Project teachers all the time in all the places. And then do things like invite myself, like, I really want to be part of an honorary part of the San Jose Area Writing Project now. That's okay, right?
You're more than welcome. More than welcome.
Thank you. It seems like a lovely place to hang out in and do a lot of work together.
You have chocolate too, Tanya.
You know, that is actually common a lot across many writing projects as well. I don't know if we'll have time for everyone to jump in on this or even if any of you will have anything to say, but a line that really struck me as I was reading your book was from your colleague, Martin. His last name
Branch.
Is... Thank
Branch.
You. Right. And he was writing about working with students on sentences and some work sentence, understanding sentence structures and sentence combining. But he said about the work that when he approached, the switch for him was that he was suddenly asking students to consider some of the possibilities of writing rather than its limits. And I thought that was really lovely. And I thought actually it was emblematic of maybe all of the work represented in the book. So I want to ask you if there's anything you'd like to say about in ways that we haven't yet talked about, how you think this book can help teachers or students consider the possibilities of writing or of teaching writing rather than the limits.
I think one of the most important aspects of the book, as I had a chance to read it over pretty much word for word from beginning to end as we were doing the final editing of our chapters not too many weeks ago, and what jumped out at me from that experience was, this is not a book that has a single voice that tells you how to do something. And I thought there's great value in that, because just as all students are a little different from one another, and all teachers are. So as you go about a writing task, you may well find that the Marty Brandt voice is the one that really helps you with your moving forward, or the Brandi Jensen voice is the one that really helps you move forward, or the Jay Richards or the Jonathan Lovell voice. And it's very encouraging, I think, to have a group of people. It's rather like the notion of taking a village to raise a child. We've got a village here. And we hope we'll be raising a lot of children.
I'd like to mention one of all of these writers, teacher authors, were all in San Jose. But Maria Clinton, who's written several chapters, is now teaching in Colorado. And Maria's voice and her insights are just really so wonderful. We keep wishing it's going to be nice she actually gets to present with us at NCTE. But there's something so good about, I was just thinking of that whole notion of Maria introduces the types of writers, and she talks about the reluctant writer and the formula writer and the poetic writer. Anyway, that's where all of us are. And, you know, and we all meet people in those areas. And I think that's a piece that can help people get to the, here's where I am, but it doesn't mean where I have to stay. And I can move.
That's nice. Thank you. I want to say that we're almost out of time. So two things. One is, Jonathan, I believe that you are going to present a roundtable about the process of creating a book through your writing project, Culture. Does that sort of capture it at the annual meeting?
Yes, my that's right. So at the NWP annual meeting in Boston, I think, is that a Thursday session, Tanya?
Yes.
I'm trying to remember. The Thursday session sponsored by the Writing Project, you're actually the first person that told me that I'll actually be doing it.
Surprise!
I submit the session proposal, but I haven't heard anything in response. But yes, that will be my role, is to actually I'll be bringing copies of the book for people who wish to purchase them at a significantly reduced price. But mostly I'll be talking about what we did in order to go through the step-by-step process of putting this book together.
That's fantastic. I would like to thank you all for being on the show tonight. I'd like to encourage all our listeners to go out and get the book because it's beautiful. And I thank you very much for your generosity in being here tonight. But as it's seen in the book, your generosity towards students, towards teachers, and especially toward each other is really shined out in the book, and it has shown tonight in the show. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
And good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.